friends. Welcome back for another episode of the It's Murder Y'all podcast. I'm your host, Amber, and with me today is a man who may one day be the reason why I have my own episode of Snapped, my husband, Rob. Say hey, Rob.
Am I that annoying?
No. Sometimes. No, I'm just kidding. So, last week we finished up our initial foray into Georgia, and we're moving on to a new state, South Carolina.
So
I've not decided yet if I want to do five cases from South Carolina, like I did with Alabama, Tennessee, and Georgia, or if I want to pick cases from a variety of states. Y'all let me know on Instagram, and I'll also try to figure out how to add the poll option in Spotify. So that being said, let's begin our journey in South Carolina. Also, here's your trigger warning for a couple brief mentions of sexual assault. So it's Friday, May 16th, 2003, and 28-year-old David Holtzclaw has driven up from his home in Tallahassee, Florida, to visit his mama, Sylvia Holtzclaw, back home in Greer, South Carolina. He hadn't been able to spend Mother's Day with her because of work. He worked in sports marketing for Florida State University, and FSU was hosting a softball tournament that weekend, and he needed to be at it. Since he couldn't spend Mother's Day with her, he decided to drive up and spend that next weekend with her and his older brother, Kevin. The Holtzclaw boys were really close to their mama, Sylvia. Sylvia had been born and raised in Greer. She had married her high school sweetheart, but sadly got divorced when David was 10 years old. From that point, she raised David and Kevin as a single mom, and she doted on her boys, often sacrificing things for herself so that they could be taken care of. She was well-known and well-loved in the community. She was super involved in her church, in the local community, and with the local high school. Sylvia was very outgoing, loved to talk, and was one of those people who never met a stranger, which made her well-suited for a career in banking. She had been in the banking industry for several years, and she developed such a rapport with people that when she had moved banks due to buyouts or mergers or whatever, those people would switch to whatever bank she was at. Which I feel like that's saying a lot, considering what a pain in the ass it is to close and open a bank account.
Yeah.
Like, those people had to have loved her. So, Sylvia had been working with Blue Ridge Savings Bank for a little over a year, commuting about an hour each way to her branch in Hendersonville, North Carolina, when it was announced that a branch was going to open up in Greer. Obviously, Sylvia was jazzed because long commutes are the worst. And of course, she was immediately hired. And according to some reports, she was either branch manager or head teller. So she wasn't just like a regular teller. Like she was a little higher up. She was the shit. So on that Friday, May 16th, 2003, Sylvia had planned to work until lunchtime. Then she, David, and Kevin were going to go on a tour of the local BMW plant. Fun fact. Greer, South Carolina, has the largest BMW manufacturing facility in North America. That tour was something they'd had planned for a while, and Sylvia was really excited about it. Unfortunately, the person who was supposed to relieve her called in sick, meaning that Sylvia had to cover the afternoon shift at the bank and wouldn't be able to go on the tour with her boys. She was pissed. And even worse, since she'd planned on leaving at lunchtime, she hadn't even brought a lunch or anything. So she calls Kevin to tell him the news, and then he calls David, who's already out gallivanting, and asks him to run some lunch over to Sylvia at the bank. David arrived at the bank at about 12:50, gave Sylvia her sandwich. I think I read somewhere that it was from Arby's, and chatted for
Man, Arby's is one of the goats.
Especially back then. It's not as great anymore, but back in the day. Don't even get me started on the 5 for $5. You can barely get one sandwich for $5 now. Like, tell me
I
you're
feel
all...
like a $5 bill is what a $1 bill used to be.
It really is. We're turning into those old people. So David brings her the sandwich. They chat for a couple minutes. Then David leaves, and he drove about 20 minutes over to the mall in Greenville to spend a gift card he had. About an hour or an hour and a half later, David gets a call from one of his close friends. And the friend is like, hey, where are you? And David's like, I'm at the mall. And the friend's like, cool, stay there. I'm going to come get you. And David's like, what do you mean come get me? Like, I drove my car here. And my friend's like, no, just stay there. I'm going to come get you. And David's like, bruh, I'm a grown-ass adult. I don't need you to come get me. What is going on? They keep going back and forth. And the friend's like, dude, I don't want to tell you this over the phone, which is obviously not a sentence anyone wants to hear. And David keeps pressing him, though. And the friend finally says, I don't know how to tell you this, but there was a robbery at the bank and your mom has been killed. So let's go back a little bit to when David dropped off Sylvia's lunch, again, at around 12:50. So like I said, they chatted. Sylvia was the only one there, which we will come back to in a minute. Things seemed fine, and David left. At around 1:30, the bank's silent alarm was triggered, and police showed up on the scene about 13 minutes later. Detective Dale Arterburn was enjoying lunch at Fat's Cafe when he got a call about a bank robbery.
Ooh.
Side note. I miss Fat's
Cafe. Them little rolls, boy. Oh. Yes.
I went to look up while I was writing this, I went to look up, you know, where is the closest Fats Cafe?
South Carolina.
They've all gone out of business.
No.
I'm so sad. So for those of y'all
that
not.
That place hit, dude.
Oh, it did. So for those of you.
Shrimp and grits.
Yep. See, you've not even read my notes, but that's my next sentence. For those of y'all not familiar, Fats Cafe was a restaurant that served like Southern and like low country food. I love their shrimp and grits and their shrimp po' boy. And they had these little rolls that were like little bread balls. And they had this honey, and they had like poppy seeds on them. And they had this honey butter. It was so good. We ate Fats a lot when I was pregnant. That was one of my places. Oh, I'm missing. I can't ever have it again. Makes me sad. So Detective Arterburn gets a call that there's a bank robbery, and he heads over to the bank. So let's talk about the actual bank for a second. First of all, it's not in like a regular building. It's in a trailer. Legit, like a trailer you would see in a trailer park trailer. Like, I'll show you a picture later. And for those of y'all listening, I will post a picture to Instagram. Like, it's a single wide trailer, my dude, but it's a bank. So that's a choice. And that's also strike one. Secondly, it was on a dead end frontage road. So Rob, do you know what a frontage road is?
I mean, I feel like I kind of do, but.
Okay. So I kept seeing that word over and over and over again when I was researching, because I actually think that the name of the road is actually Frontage Road. But I had no idea what it was. So I checked Wikipedia. And according to Wikipedia, quote, a frontage road, also known as an access road, outer road, service road, feeder road, or parallel road, is a local is a local road running parallel to a higher speed limited access road. A frontage road is often used to provide access to private driveways, shops, houses, industries, or farms, end quote. So in this case, the bank was on a dead-end access road right next to I-85. No, thank
you. That's pretty stupid.
Yeah. Thirdly, because it was a small branch, Sylvia was frequently there by herself, which she did not mention to David and Kevin, but she did bring up concerns about it to some of her friends. So when I worked at a bank for exactly 1 month, we always had to have at least two people there at all times. Like, I was hired to work the 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. shift, and I think it was just so that the people that worked there could get lunch. Sometimes, like, if our manager was out, I would go grab lunch for the other tellers before I left to go home, because neither one of them could leave. So I'm not sure if having at least two people working is a rule at every bank, but I kind of feel like it should be. And the final note about the bank is that the door was supposed to be set up where you had to be buzzed in so that people couldn't just, like, walk in all willy-nilly when the tellers were alone. But unfortunately, the door wasn't working that day, and Sylvia had actually called that morning to have someone come out and look at it. Makes you wonder if we'd be talking about this case if the door had been functioning like it was supposed to. So Detective Arterburn heads over to the sketchy little bank trailer and starts walking through it, and he's not seeing anybody or anything. There were two cars parked out front, but there's not a soul around. So he finally gets to a back room. Some sources call it a break room. Some call it a utility room. And there he finds the bodies of 56-year-old Sylvia Holtzclaw, 61-year-old Eb Barnes, and his 58-year-old wife, Maggie Barnes.
Damn.
All three were dead from gunshot wounds. So before we dive deeper into that, let's take a moment to discuss Eb and Maggie Barnes. Dr. James Elbert Barnes, better known as Eb, was a retired professor who had taught physics for 28 years at the University of South Carolina, Spartanburg, which is now known as the University of South Carolina, Upstate. He was a popular professor, and as it would turn out, three of the officers who arrived at the crime scene that day had been his former students, which I can't even imagine. Like, I can't even imagine. I also read that at the winter graduation ceremony each year at USC Spartanburg, Dr. Barnes would wear a Santa hat with his regalia, which was made even better by the fact that he had a long gray beard. So he was like Dr. Santa Claus, which I thought was cute. Eb had been married to Margaret Melton Barnes, better known as Maggie, for 38 years. They'd met at King College in Bristol, Tennessee, and were married in 1965 at the Bethesda Presbyterian Church in McConnell, South Carolina, where her daddy was the pastor. Maggie was an illustrious spinner and weaver, selling her spun and woven goods at craft fairs throughout the Southeast, and even giving demonstrations in period costumes of traditional Carolina blackwork embroidery and weaving. In addition to weaving, Maggie had worked for many years for the National Beta Club of Spartanburg. Eb and Maggie had three children, two daughters and a son, and six grandchildren. On that Friday, May 16th, Eb and Maggie had driven over to the Blue Ridge Savings Bank to move some money into their IRA account. That's the thing about the Blue Ridge Savings Bank. It wasn't what you think of when you think of a traditional bank. It handled mostly savings, loans, mortgages, stuff like that, which means it wouldn't have a lot of cash on hand. Like, it wasn't a place where, like, people are going and cashing their check or, like, depositing, you know, things like that. That's not what that was. So it was a weird choice for a bank to rob. And beyond that, it's rare for people to die during the commission of a bank robbery. Most of the time, bank robbers are just there to get their money and leave. As Detective Arterburn said, quote, "Big shootouts at banks, that's Hollywood drama. It's a rarity that somebody actually discharges a firearm, let alone gets hurt in a bank robbery," end quote. According to data published by the FBI, in 2003, which is the year this murder/robbery happened, 7,465 banking institutions were robbed, and 21 people died during the commission of those robberies. Of the 21 deaths, 3 were customers and 2 were employees. 14 were the perpetrators, 1 was a guard, and 1 was listed as other. So of the 5 customers out of all almost 7,500 bank robberies, of the 5 customers or employees that were murdered, 3 of them were from the Blue Ridge Savings Bank robbery. So this triple homicide, which was the first ever triple homicide in Greer, was very out of the ordinary. Interestingly enough, I looked up the data for 2021. That was like the most recent year they published. And there were only like 1,000-something bank robberies, which is down a lot from the almost 7,500 in 2003. I don't know if because COVID was still kind of going on in 2021 or if like technology's gotten better and it's harder to commit crimes, but I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
So Detective Arterburn is there. He's at the bank. He's found the bodies and it's time to start investigating. So unfortunately, there isn't a lot to work with. They have the shell casings, which show that the weapon was a 40 Glock pistol, but there was no sign of a struggle, so there wasn't any blood outside of the utility room where the murders happened. There were no random fibers, and it'd be pointless to test for fingerprints because it was a bank, and like all kinds of people were in and out of the place throughout the day touching stuff. So police hope So police hoped that the bank's surveillance footage would be the break they needed. It was 2003, so the surveillance camera was connected to a VHS recording device. When police go to review the tape, they find that, dun, 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 there was no tape. So they figure that one of two things happened. A, no one put a tape in to begin with, or B, the perpetrator took the tape with him. David Holtzclaw was confident that it was option B, asserting, quote, "My mom was extremely safety conscious. I actually found out that she had a book of procedures that she had written and kept notes with opening and closing the bank. She was responsible for making sure tape for the cameras was up to date and everything that needed to be done from that side. 100% confident in that. No question about it," end quote. Now, obviously, I didn't know Sylvia, but from what I've read about her, I feel like she was the kind of lady that dotted her I's and crossed her T's. So I doubt that she forgot to load that tape.
Yeah.
But that does bring me to, and it's murder, y'all, PSA/life rule. And that is, if you work at a place that has a security camera, please make sure that bitch is actually working and has a fresh tape in it. We need all the footage we can get when a crime goes down because there's
make
so
make sure that bitch is working.
the number of crimes that go unsolved because like, yeah, they had a security camera, but it didn't work or wasn't plugged in or didn't have a tape. Like, why have them if they don't work? So since they didn't have any recorded footage of what went on in the bank, investigators hoped that they could find some footage of what went on outside the bank. From what I gather, the entrance to that frontage road was at the intersection of I-85 and Highway 14, and there was a gas station there that had surveillance cameras. Unfortunately, it was 2003, so the footage was hella grainy, and it looked like it was filmed in a microwave. According to Detective Arterburn, quote, "It's the worst quality that you could possibly have for cleaning up the video, and it's very difficult to work with what we have," end quote. They ended up using NASA technology, don't even know what that means, to enhance the footage as much as possible, and here's what they saw. At 1:25 p.m., a red car was spotted driving towards the bank. 3 minutes later, at 1:28 p.m., the Barnes' Ford Ranger was spotted driving towards the bank. At 1:32 p.m., so this was 2 minutes after the silent alarm was triggered, the red car was seen driving away from the bank. Police couldn't make out what kind of car the red vehicle was, so they enlisted the help of some experts. Some sources said they were General Motors engineers, and others said that they were experts from Car and Driver magazine. Regardless of who they were, they determined that the red blur on the camera was actually a red Oldsmobile Alero. So the Oldsmobile, why is that word so hard to say?
They got all that from They got all that from a grainy microwave video.
So interestingly enough, this happens quite often. There are people that I guess their special interest is cars. Like they are experts. So the same thing happened, if I'm not mistaken, with the murder of those four college students in Idaho. That's where it was, right? Idaho?
Yeah.
Yeah. They had surveillance video of this white car. And so they got these experts to narrow it down to even like beyond make and model, even down to like the year, I think, that it was produced, and they were spot on. So
I know a lot of rednecks can do that with muscle cars and all kind of cars and shit. Yeah, that right there is your 68 Ford Falcon. It's got that split bumper on there. You know, them blinkers are round instead of flat like the 71s, you know. You know what I mean?
That is literally it. It makes me think of the courtroom scene in My Cousin Vinny.
Mm-hmm.
So the Oldsmobile Alero was only in production from 1998 to 2004. And according to one source, was bought primarily by rental companies, like car rental companies. Investigators tracked down every single person in the upstate area who owned a red Oldsmobile Alero, which ended up being about 100 people, but they were all cleared. In October 2004, a year and a half after the triple homicide, police chased down a red Oldsmobile Alero near Eastman, Georgia. The driver jumped out of the car, fled on foot, and he's a runner, he's a track star, because he ended up getting away. Police ran the car's VIN number, and it matched a car that had been stolen from a rental car place at the Columbia Airport back in May of 2003, 13 days before the murder. Can we take a moment to acknowledge the fact that he was driving around a stolen car for a year and a half? Like, how does that happen? How, like...
Listen, it's as much random pot and crack that the cops pull off of the side of the road from a random taillight being out, just as many lucky criminals or lucky scenarios like that. Look, bro, I like I told you, I drove around with unknowingly a suspended license for like 9 months.
Yeah, but like
I had no idea.
Right, but
I completely forgotten about that ticket.
Right, but that is from like a random speeding ticket. This is a person who stole a car.
Right, but if you just, you know.
So, like, that means for a year and a half that he didn't have any traffic violations or, like.
Right, yeah, he just got lucky, just, you know.
That's just crazy whatever. To me. I would not have that luck. So, a 40 Glock pistol, which was the same type of gun used in the Blue Ridge Savings murders, was found in the car. But ballistics testing showed that it was not the murder weapon. Fingerprints taken from inside the car matched a man.
Glock 40, by the way.
Glock 40?
Yeah, that's what typically hear people say.
Good to know. I don't know shit about guns. Glock 40.
Glock 40.
You may have to correct me because I'm pretty sure I have 40 Glock written everywhere. So.
Sounds like a rapper name or something.
I feel like 40 Glock sounds 40 better Glock. Than Glock 40, but whatever. So fingerprint.
You know what? You can call it whatever you want. It's a Glock 40, but it's tomato, tomato. Who cares? It's a 40 Glock, bro.
Yeah, but I like to be accurate. But what I want to know now is why everyone else in the sources said a 40 Glock. I feel like they even said it.
A
let me 40
check. Caliber Glock is what, I mean, maybe they mean by that.
Hold on. Oh, yeah. Okay. 40. Okay. I was going to check Unsolved Mysteries. They said 40 caliber Glock. So maybe I'm stupid. But, okay. Glock 40. Glock 40.
Well, that's what they probably mean then. Because I was like wondering why you're.
Yeah, it's a 40 caliber.
Usually when you refer to Glocks by their nomenclature, you say the Glock and then their number. Glock 19, Glock 20, Glock 30, whatever it is. I don't know. There's a shitload of them.
I want to know whose fault it was. Is it my fault? 40 caliber, 40 caliber, Glock. Yeah, I think that's my fault. They all said 40 caliber.
Can you not read, bud?
I cannot read. I went to school in Alabama.
Get your shit together. You're a professional podcaster out here shitting the bed right now.
I am. So, it was a 40 caliber Glock, just so that we are all clear. But again, you may have to remind me as I'm reading this, because I get ahead of myself. So, fingerprints.
Wrong with your 40 Glock, having ass.
Fingerprints. Fingerprints taken from inside the car matched a man named Emerson Wright, who, as it turns out, was wanted by the Georgia Bureau of Investigation for arson and robbery. Emerson Wright, who also went by Ernest Wright and Akeem Johnson, was basically a career criminal. He'd been convicted of burglary and aggravated assault on police in 1985, eluding an officer in 1987, receiving stolen property in 1994, and burglary in 2002. And now, he's been found with a stolen car that matches one seen near a murder, and he was in possession of a gun a 40 caliber Glock that was the same kind that was used in the murder. Not looking great for Emerson. Investigators in Georgia knew about the Blue Ridge Savings case, so they passed Emerson's info over to the investigators back in South Carolina. This was a really good lead, and the Greer police really wanted to sit down and have a chat with old Mr. Wright. Unfortunately, they would not get that chance, because the next year, in August 2005, after leading police in a high-speed chase on I-20, Emerson crashed his vehicle near Eatonton, Georgia, got out of his car, and shot himself in the head with a 40 caliber Glock, 40 Glock pistol. It says 40 Glock in my notes. 40 caliber Glock pistol.
That's a special Glock.
It is. Greer
Most
police
people don't know about it.
They don't. It's secret. Greer police's best suspect took anything he knew about the crime to the grave. There were a couple other suspects that police considered over the years. One was a man who'd admitted to robbing 17 banks throughout the upstate and Midlands areas of South Carolina. He denied committing the Blue Ridge Savings Bank robbery, though, and it's important to note that he had never harmed anyone during any of his robberies. And I'm purposefully not saying his name because I wasn't sure how to pronounce it, and I didn't want to sound dumb because I've already sounded dumb with the 40 Glock. Early on...
That can be your pen name when you write a book.
Yes. If you see anything about 40 Glock, you know it's me. So early on, the FBI released a sketch of a man that witnesses had seen near the bank on the day of the robbery. And those witness descriptions tend to be, if we remember nothing from the Blockbuster murders, which I want to clarify from that episode, we were 100% making fun of the murderer, only making fun of the murderer. We were not making fun of anybody else but the murderer because he was a douche bucket. So the person in this case was described as being in his early 50s, white with blonde hair that was graying, portly. Between 5'6".
I have no idea what they mean by that.
Yep. Between 5'6 and 5'8, and he was acting shady.
Shady little pudgy man.
Yep.
portly.
a portly little short king.
Portly little man.
It makes me think of the episode of Bob's Burgers I was telling you about, where there's someone in the restaurant that looks sketchy, and so Bob won't let the girls go over. He told Gene that he can go because he won't get molested, and Gene's like, why wouldn't I get molested? And Bob's like, well, you're heavy.
You're portly.
You're portly. Investigators found two individuals that fit that description, the bank's janitor and a businessman from North Carolina, but both were cleared. I hope I'm never anywhere near a crime, because I will get my feelings hurt if someone describes me, because they're always bad. It's never like, this was a smoking hot person whose skin was immaculate. Like, no, they're going to pick out your flaws. It's like a caricature of yourself. So suspect number one dead, other suspects cleared or not super connected. Well, 2016. So what, this is like 13 years after the murders, police got what they hoped would be the break they needed when a suspect was arrested for a quadruple murder that happened 6 months after the Blue Ridge Savings Bank. On November the 6th, 2003, four employees were found gunned down in Superbike Motorsports, a high-performance motorcycle shop located in Chesney, South Carolina, which is about 35 miles away from Greer. Among the murdered were owner Scott Ponder, his mother Beverly Guy, service manager Brian Lucas, and mechanic Chris Sherbert. According to
talk about this before?
You and I have, which I actually note in here later that I hope you didn't remember it. Because I didn't. This is a really...
An elephant never forgets, baby.
So what about that Drano I needed from the grocery store?
Listen, mistakes were made.
They were. I texted it to you.
It was a pandemonium.
You had a list.
People were... I did.
That was the one... I needed that and cornbread, and I got neither of those things.
Well, listen, cornbread was not happening. If it was anything other than rye bread or keto bread, you were shit out of luck, unless you wanted to make hot dog, if you want a hot dog or hamburger buns.
Well, I mean, those rolls you got worked out well, but yeah, I didn't.
That was the last pack of them.
I didn't need the Drano. But that's okay. I'll just shower in 6 inches of standing water. It's fine. So anyways, okay. Got to get serious. I'm about to talk about murder. Talking about murder, getting serious, because I don't want people to think I'm a horrible person. So, because I can't be dumb and horrible. According to True Crime Daily, Scott's friend Noel, that's hard for me to say, Noel, called him and said that he was going to come by the shop. When Noel got there, seven minutes later. He found Scott's body in the parking lot, Brian's body outside near the door, Chris's body in the back of the shop, bent over as though he'd been working on a bike. Beverly was also found in the back of the shop, having been ambushed coming out of the bathroom. Now, I don't want to make light of a horrible situation, but I do not want to be found dead inside of or coming out of a bathroom. We can add that to my list of ways I don't want to be found dead.
Yeah.
Along with being found naked. Like, I know that everybody pees and poops, but I don't want to call attention to it. And I don't want to be like Elvis and people be like, yeah, oh my God, she died on the toilet. It's just like a weird thing I have. So that is very unfortunate. So we're now going to go on a crazy little side tangent related to the Superbike murders, just because it's fucking insane. And I've told it to you before, Rob. And as I wrote in my notes, hopefully you forgot or weren't paying attention. If it turns out you were.
He was.
So just pretend like you've not already heard
this. I just like to let it go on record as having been proven that I do pay attention and listen when you speak.
Except for when I need things from the grocery store.
Listen, it was this one time.
Did you get me some Diet Coke?
Yes.
Okay. I was about to leave my post and go into your room and punch you in the throat if you also forgot my Diet Coke. I will end up with my episode of Snapped over my Diet Coke.
I might go out
Coke.
There and throw your Diet Coke in the snow.
I'll burn all your root beer.
Ma'am.
All of it. You probably bought a lot of it too.
Mm-mm.
How much root beer did you buy?
2 12 packs.
Oh, that's not as bad as I thought. Was that all I had?
I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know?
I plead the fifth.
That was all. Was that really? Was that all I had?
Yes, it was.
So for y'all, I say if you're all listening, of course you're listening. That's how you're hearing this. But so in Knoxville, it fucking snowed. Like we got like a solid 9 inches, I would say. It's mm-hmm. snow. It's snowing right now. We live very high up. Like the hill that we live on is so steep that when you get to the bottom of our subdivision, your ears pop. And so there's like no leaving. But Rob was out of his sugar. Was it diet root beer?
Sugar-free. Zero sugar A&W root beer. Yeah.
He didn't ration it and he was out. So he called a friend of his who has a Jeep to drive over here and drive him to the grocery store so that he could get.
It wasn't just for the root beer.
That
it was
your...
for the hangs. It was to see what the roads look like. And it was to get meat and stuff for groceries.
And it was to disregard most of the list of things I wanted.
I tried for the cornbread.
Yeah, but I needed.
You don't need to just let the Drano and the cornbread go and know.
I'm cool with the cornbread because the rolls ended up being better. Although you were being a turd about it. Like, I really like
cornbread in that soup, though.
Well, it turns out me and your daughter like the rolls. So you're outnumbered.
This is the case on most things.
So you get a pass with the cornbread because the rolls were a better choice. But I'm pretty sure Drano, I'm gonna look at my list. I'm pretty sure Drano was the number one thing that I put on the list. Where's the list?
Listen.
Yep, Drano, right there on the top. Anyways, so getting back to this, that you conveniently are going to remember when the one time I don't need you to remember. But hopefully people that are listening aren't familiar because this is crazy. So when someone is murdered, who is the first person they always look at? The spouse. So, of course, investigators started with Melissa Ponder, who is married to the owner of the Superbike Motorsports. Nope, the Superbike shop. I just forgot what it was called. Scott Ponder. He owned it. So Melissa was pregnant.
The motorcycle shop?
Yep. Melissa was pregnant when Scott was murdered, which is just god awful. I can't even imagine. Like, being pregnant is an adventure anyways. And then, like, your husband died. God bless her. So shortly after she had the baby, the police called her up to the station for some questioning. While she was there, she had to change the baby's diaper. And unbeknownst to her, the police took the diaper and they did a DNA test to see if the baby was Scott's. Because they were thinking, maybe this was like a love triangle gone wrong or something. Well, lo and behold, the DNA test showed that Scott Ponder was not the father of Melissa's baby. Service manager Brian Lucas was. Police told Melissa the news and she was like, absolutely fucking not. I'm going to need you to do another test. So they did do another test. And again, it showed that Brian Lucas was the father, not Scott Ponder. So this, of course, starts all kinds of drama. Scott's family's pissed at Melissa. It's a whole thing. And the whole time, Melissa's like, what the hell is happening? According to True Crime Daily, Melissa told investigators, quote, we worked hard for that baby. We had to have medical procedures to have this baby. I know he's the father of my baby, end quote. Like, she was adamant that Scott was the only person that could be the father of that baby. But police continued to treat her as though she was some kind of cheating hussy who had arranged her husband's murder. Then, after 18 months, someone decided to compare Scott's DNA to his mother Beverly's DNA. And what do you know? Their DNA didn't match. As it turns out, Scott's and Brian's bodies were found close to each other, and somehow their blood vials got mixed up and mislabeled. Oops. So for 18 months, they treated this widow, who was a new mother who just lost her husband, as though she had done it, and that she was stepping out on her husband and had a baby that wasn't his. So I couldn't find out what happened after that, but I hope she sued their kneecaps off, because for fuck's sake, like, that is a big error to make. Like,
I'll have your kneecaps for this.
She needed to either sue or break some kneecaps, because, like, you can't be, that's, I can't even imagine. So the Superbike murders went unsolved until November 2016, when Todd Kohlhepp confessed while being interrogated for other murders. On November the 3rd, police found a woman chained to a wall inside of a storage container on Todd's property. She and her husband had been missing since August 31st, after they'd been hired to remove brush from one of Todd's properties. Thankfully, the woman was still alive.
I remember this.
Yeah, I know. Thankfully, the woman was still alive, but her husband's body was found buried on the property, along with the bodies of another couple who'd been missing since December of 2015. Todd was arrested, and at some point in the questioning was like, oh, you know the murders at that motorcycle place in Chesney? That was me. So let me tell you a little bit more about the narcissistic turd that is Todd Kohlhepp. First of all, his daddy said about him, quote, "The only emotion he was capable of was anger and madness," end quote. He'd been a giant psychopathic red flag since he was in preschool, where he was known to be aggressive to the other children and destroy their property. He even spent 3.5 months in an inpatient psychiatric hospital because of his inability to get along with other children. In November 1986, 15-year-old Todd Kohlhepp kidnapped his 14-year-old neighbor at gunpoint, took her to his house, tied her to a chair, and raped her, before walking her home and threatening to kill her entire family if she told anybody. Thankfully, she called his bluff and immediately told what happened, and Todd was charged with kidnapping, sexual assault, and committing a dangerous crime against children. He ended up pleading guilty to the kidnapping charge, and the other charges were dropped. How or why they dropped the sexual assault charges are beyond me, but I guess it was just a combination of the 80s and people not really giving a shit about women. So Todd served 14 of his 15-year sentence and was released in August 2001 and promptly moved to South Carolina, where his shit-ass mama was at the time. Don't worry, we will talk about her more in a bit. In news that is shocking to no one, Todd was the shammiest of all the shammers, and he was able to get his real estate license in 2006, despite being a registered sex offender, because he lied on his application. I guess they weren't big on background checks. He somehow ended up building a very successful real estate firm and was recognized as a top-selling agent in the Carolina region. In 2014, he purchased a 100-acre plot of land, which he enclosed with an $80,000 fence. I believe this is where the chained-up woman and buried bodies were found.
Yes.
Yes. So, going back to the Superbike murders, why did Todd Kohlhepp brutally murder 4 strangers in broad daylight? Well, from what I gather, Todd had bought a motorcycle from the shop, and something happened to it. Like, I think it may have gotten stolen or something. And he went back to buy a new one, and the guys picked at him about it, and they were like, oh, don't go get this one stolen or something like that. You know, just typical, like, dudes messing with dude shit. It's how y'all always are. Well, it hurt Todd's fragile little man feelings, so he came back and murdered all of them. According to his mother, though, Todd had bought a motorcycle and tried to return it, at which point they, quote, laughed at him, made jokes at him, end quote. Now, ladies, gents, and non-binary friends, I need you to know that Todd Kohlhepp's mama was what the children nowadays might call DeLulu. Have you heard of DeLulu, Rob? I know you're old and you're not
a little bit. Yeah.
So she was DeLulu. She told reporters that Todd wasn't a monster. He was just, quote, very misunderstood, end quote. In addition to discussing his motive for the Superbike murders, she explained that he killed the husband of the kidnapped woman, quote, because he got nasty and was smart mouthed, end quote. As for why he had a woman chained up in a storage building, she said, quote, she saw him kill her boyfriend and he didn't know what to do with her. Couldn't turn her loose, she'd go tell the police, end quote. I mean, obviously, he couldn't. Ma'am. And it gets worse, y'all. It gets worse. So back in 1987, during the whole, like, you know, the trial and stuff for the kidnapping and the raping, of a 14-year-old girl, his mother begged for leniency and later wrote to his probation officer saying, quote, Todd knows he did wrong and he's sorry, but they won't even give him a chance to make a good life out of this. They don't even stop to think that he even walked the girl home. Does that sound like a dangerous criminal? End quote. For fuck's sake. I can't. She's giving...
People jump through all kind of hoops.
She's giving Latrell energy from the Santa Claus case, and I just can't. Like, y'all can't be out here defending your shit-ass kids like that. Like, I know it's hard because they're your babies, but you got to face the reality that maybe your kid, you know, the one that admitted to murdering multiple people, like, maybe they're possibly a shitty person. Like, I just... I can't like the mental gymnastics, like the cognitive dissonance. I just to sit there and say, well, he walked her home. And what does that have to do with anything? You crazy ass heifer. She's dead now. So whatever. So all the way back to 2003, when the Superbike murders happened, people were speculating that it might be connected to the Blue Ridge Savings Bank murders. Because after all, they were 6 months and 30 miles apart. But as it stands, Todd Culhepp has denied any involvement in those murders. It is important to note, though, that Todd has made it clear more than once that he has murdered more people than the ones that the police and public know about. Right after his arrest in 2016, he told his mama that there were a lot more victims. She asked how many, and he replied, quote, you don't have enough fingers, end quote. He wrote to the Spartanburg Herald Journal in 2017 and claimed to have additional victims. And in a 2019 documentary called Serial Killer, Devil Unchained, he told an investigative journalist that the reported body count is, quote, not even close to accurate, end quote, and that there are considerably more people than the seven that are known. He said that he committed crimes before the Superbike murders and that there was not a lull between the 2003 Superbike murders and the murder of the first couple in 2015. He hasn't given any additional information because he is a narcissistic, psychopathic, shit-ass turd and we hate him.
I think he's full of shit, kind of. I think there may be more victims, but I think he's trying to inflate it to get clout or whatever.
I agree.
Serial killer clout.
Yeah. He's trying to stay relevant and look like Billy Badass. And
yeah.
And we hate it. It's gross. So it has been 20 years since Sylvia Holtzclaw, Ed Barnes, and Maggie Barnes were brutally murdered in the Blue Ridge Savings Bank. And sadly, this case is still unsolved. Many people think that Emerson Wright was the best suspect, but the evidence against him is circumstantial at best. Glocks, 40 caliber ones to be specific, are a very popular gun. I did not know that, but those sources told me that because I don't know shit about guns. And
it's probably the most popular handgun in America.
Well, there we go. Any particular reason?
It's just super reliable. They perform. They're just good at shooting.
They're good at shooting people.
They're good at the pew pew. Yeah.
Okay. They do
the pew-pews good.
I'm not going to get on my soapbox. So Glocks are a very popular gun. And although a red Oldsmobile
Alera... I feel like just to defend guns for just a split second, some people look at a firearm as a tool rather than, you know, like I think a lot of people get it confused that they're made for killing people. But sometimes you can think of it as like a tool. You know what I mean? That's all.
You're going to have to elaborate. I mean, like a Glock specifically, because you're not going to hunt a deer with a Glock.
Well, no, but I would carry a Glock in my truck just in case some shit pops off or whatever, just for protection in general. You know what I mean? It's not for me. That's a tool. That's a tool in my everyday carry list of items. You know what I mean?
You carry a gun with you?
No.
Okay. I was about to say. So, Glocks are a very popular gun, and although a red Oldsmobile Alera was seen on security cameras, we don't know if that car was actually related to the murder. And sadly, I'm doubtful that this case will ever be solved. So that is the case of the Blue Ridge Savings Bank murders. Rob, what are your thoughts?
I mean, it was pretty straightforward. I think that it's sad that I don't know. There are things that could have probably prevented that from happening, to be honest.
And, for sure.
People be... lazy with the details. Like, why are you going to put a bank right next to an interstate where people can park on the shoulder and walk through the woods or whatever, rob your bank, and then hit the road?
Exactly. Like, I mean, it was right parallel to I-85. Which, did you take I-85 to get from Columbia to Charlotte?
If I recall.
Because if you did, you passed by this place. because it was like right off the interstate, and it's a dead end. And yeah, that's just, I don't know who thought that was a good idea. And then I think about like the butterfly effect of all, like, what if she hadn't been there? Well, I don't know if it would have made a difference if she hadn't been there alone, but like, you know, if the door had worked right. And then I think about the person that called out, like, if they felt like survivor's guilt because, you know, if they hadn't called out, it would have been them. There's a good bit of information that the police haven't released. They've never released how much money was stolen. But what they've said is whoever it was, they took the money from, I guess, like the register, but not any of the cash reserves, which they may not have been able to get into. They probably couldn't have gotten into the safe. Yeah. But like, not that much is kept in the drawers.
Yeah.
From what I recall, we kept a certain amount and anything beyond that went into the safe. So the person didn't get away with much, certainly not enough to kill three people. There was one report very early on that I read that I think said that two of the victims had been shot in the head, one had been shot in the chest, but none of the other sources said, some of the other sources noted that the police hadn't specifically said, because basically like they keep information like that close to the vest so that if someone confesses or if they find somebody, they have information that only the killer would know, because people be crazy and they'll be confessing to murders and shit they didn't do, which is weird. So thank y'all so much for listening to the It's Murder Y'all podcast. As always, sources for this episode will be listed in the show notes. Please subscribe, rate, review, tell a friend, tell your mama. We'll see y'all next week. Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
Holler at Jens.